Sure Shame Podcast, shining a light to the nations.
Shalom, everybody. This is Bill, and this is our Torah portion commentary on Vayigash. Vayigash, and he approached, which is taken from Bereshit chapter 44, verse 18, all the way over to chapter 47, verse 27. What we're going to see in this Torah portion is, despite the fact that Judah has displayed some very less than desirable traits in his past, he has a checkered past marked with these unwise decisions. Yet, in this Torah portion, we're going to see that he acts very bravely and very admirably. I mean, you consider his choice for his wife in the previous Torah portion, his dealings with Tamar, of course, his betrayal of Joseph. All of those things don't portray him as being the best of people. And yet, in the previous Torah portion, and as we'll see in this Torah portion, he has made himself surety for Benjamin. He has pledged himself to stand in the stead of Benjamin, and that he would bring his brother back to his father. And so when he needed to, he steps up and he acts very courageously. He acts appropriately. Because as far as he was concerned, the man that he was speaking to was not his brother, but an Egyptian lord who had the power of life and death in his hand. So Judah's putting his life on the line as far as he's concerned. And to offer himself as a slave, not knowing that the one he was speaking to was his brother, was a very courageous thing to do. To offer himself as a slave in the stead of his brother, to be willing to lay down his life, so to speak, in a manner of speaking, reminds us what Moses did at Mount Sinai after the children of Israel had made the golden calf and the Creator was getting ready to really to wipe them out and raise up a nation for Moses. And so in Exodus 32, verse 31, it says this, "Alas, this people has sinned a great sin. They have made for themselves gods of gold. But now, if you will forgive their sin, but if not, please blot me out of your book that you have written." So in both cases, what we see here is a person who is willing to sacrifice themselves on behalf of their brethren. To extrapolate that out, on behalf of Israel, which is reminiscent of something that Paul said, by the way, who is from the tribe of Benjamin, in Romans chapter 11, verse 1. He said, "I have great sorrow and unceasing anguish in my heart, for I could wish that I myself were accursed and cut off from the Messiah for the sake of my brothers, my kinsmen, according to the flesh." So we have these great examples of people who were willing to sacrifice themselves on behalf of their brother. And I dare say that that is something that you just don't wake up with one day and decide to do. You're not necessarily born with it. I think that that is something that develops within a person over time as they draw closer to the Creator and they see His heart. Then these things will be expressed within us as well. In fact, the greatest example of the one who willingly sacrifices himself for the sake of a brother is Yeshua himself, representing the tribe of Judah. Because that's the tribe he was born into, he made himself surety to the Father of all for all of Israel, including the tribe of Benjamin, which would include a Paul. In fact, he appeared personally to Shaul, or to Paul, who again is of the tribe of Benjamin. And then after appearing to him, Paul is sent among the nations, going out and looking for the lost sheep, looking for his brothers. Messiah Yeshua is like that prophet that Moses described, a prophet likened to me who will arise from amongst your brethren. And he died on behalf of wayward Israel. Like Moses was ready to be blotted out, Yeshua put himself in that position to die on behalf of all of his brethren. Yet, Yeshua also typifies the one who is concealed from his brethren. He is typified by the one who is despised by his brethren. And like Joseph, he's going to be revealed when they have repented of their transgression. So Judah is going to play a significant role in this as well. Because what happens to the fathers is a portent for the children. I also want to add this. Joseph also typifies those who are of the body of Messiah, especially those who are not regarded as being Israel by Judah, because we don't look the part, we're in the nations, we dress like the nations, speak like the nations, etc. And so we're not regarded as being part of the family. Yet we know that we are, because we are in Messiah, we are the seed of Abraham and heirs according to the promise. In fact, that point is validated, I believe, very strongly by the Haftarah for this particular Torah portion, which is taken from Ezekiel chapter 37, verses 15 through 28, because that prophesies of the two brothers, and it refers to them in that prophecy as two sticks. By the way, that word is literally etz, or tree, or branch of a tree. But these two brothers, Joseph and Judah, because that's what they're called in the prophecy, come together as one. And so if it's Joseph and Judah, one looks like the Hebrews. One looks like the nations. But they come together as one and become one in the hand of the Father above. And in fact, that is the reason that Messiah laid down his life. Lay down his life. John chapter 10, verse 18, he says, "No man takes it," that is his life, "no man takes it from me, but I lay it down of myself. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it again. This commandment have I received of my Father." And in chapter 15, he says, "Greater love has no man than this, than a man lay down his life for his friends." And we see that others prophesied that this is what he was doing, even though they didn't acknowledge him as being the Messiah. In John chapter 11, verses 50 and 52, Caiaphas speaking says this, "Nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation perish not. And this he spoke not of himself, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Yeshua should die for that nation, and not for that nation only, but that also he should gather together in one the children of God that were scattered abroad." So all these verses here demonstrate that the Messiah came, he laid down his life, it wasn't taken from him. He voluntarily put himself as surety for all of his brethren. He willingly sacrificed his life so that others could live. And being from the tribe of Judah, and Judah in our Torah portion is going to do that on behalf of his brother Benjamin, then the Messiah in one way is being portrayed through Judah, those who are willing to sacrifice on behalf of their brethren. Again, ultimately personified in the Messiah. But at the same time, Joseph is typifying the Messiah as well. He's the one that was despised. He's the one that's concealed. He's the one that will be revealed. And when Judah recognizes his error about despising his brother. Now, as we move into the Torah portion itself, chapter 44, verse 18, it says, "Then Judah came near," and that term is Vayigash, where we get our Torah portion name from. "Then Judah came near unto him." The root term here, in plain sense, means to approach. So Judah was just approaching him. But it also implies close proximity. It's, in some cases, even used for the closeness in the sense of intimacy. The point is, Judah approached him very close. He got very, if you will, intimate with him, encroached on his space, and keeping in mind that this is an Egyptian lord, as far as Judah's concerned. So he's moving very, very close. He's very bold to approach this Egyptian lord, which reminds us of what the Creator permits when someone wishes to approach him with a repentant heart. The writer of Hebrews chapter 4 says it this way, "Seeing then that we have a great high priest that is passed into the heavens, Yeshua, the Son of God, let us hold fast our profession. For we have not an high priest, which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly under the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need." So we come boldly to the throne of grace in order to obtain mercy. And that's exactly what Judah, in a sense, is doing. He's boldly coming before this man in order to obtain a merciful decision. And little does he know that the one he's approaching is his brother, who is typifying our heavenly high priest. That's what Judah did, except he wasn't certain that he was approaching his deliverer. He was not sure what was going to happen. So in verse 18 he says, "If you please, my Lord, let your servant speak a word in your ears." And that word, of course, involves his plight. He made himself surety for Benjamin, and now he's faced with Benjamin being taken slave, and how is that going to affect his father? And so all of these emotions are pushing him to approach this man, and let me speak a word into your ear. And so it's his love and respect for his father that provokes him to do this. And he continues and says, "Let not your anger burn against me," because he's going to say some things that might anger this man as far as he knew. And during this discourse, there's some things that are said that might imply that Judah was hinting, your questions and the things you put us up to have brought us to this place. You're really the one who's put me in this predicament. Which is to say, you're the one who has orchestrated events that has brought me to the place that I am going to have to be willing to die to myself for the sake of my father's will. And so he begins recounting events up to this point. And as far as I'm concerned, it suggests that he's trying to imply, look, all your questions and your demands, that's what's brought us to this place. You're the one who's orchestrated things whereby now I find myself in a situation I've got to die to me in order that my father may be happy and that he may be pleased, which I'm hinting at something there. It also suggests that Judah is thinking or suspecting that this whole silver cup thing was a conspiracy against them. Because if Benjamin is a thief, then why does this man want a thief as a servant? In verse 19, Judah reminds Joseph his questions concerning a father and a brother. He says in verses 20 and 22, "We said to my Lord, we have a father, an old man, and a young brother, the child of his old age. His brother is dead, and he alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him. And we said to my Lord, the boy cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die." And so in this statement, we see the first time that they speak of Joseph as being dead. Perhaps that's what they believe. Perhaps if they thought he may have been alive in Egypt, well, the options of finding him are now over. So he's dead, as far as they're concerned. Which is important because that is what Israel, the man, but also what Israel, the nation, believes. Meaning that if the one who was dead is resurrected from the dead, that will bring life to Israel. That will rejuvenate Israel. But in verse 23, you said that we couldn't return here unless we brought him. And our father was very reluctant to comply with this demand. So in verses 27 through 29, Judah says, "Then your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons. One left me. And I said, surely he has been torn to pieces, and I have never seen him since. If you take this one also from me and harm happens to him, you will bring down my gray hairs in evil to Sheol." This apparently is the first time that Joseph hears what his father had to say upon his disappearance. This is when Joseph learns of what Jacob believes happened to him. And it reveals the story that was given to his father by his brothers. Yet, in Jacob's words, there is a hint of doubt that Joseph was indeed killed by beasts, because he says, "And I haven't seen him since. I haven't been able to confirm this," in other words. In verses 30 and 31, Judah argues that to return without Benjamin means Jacob's death. If I go back without his son, then he's going to die. You're going to kill him. Because, he says, his soul is bound up with the lad's, which, by the way, is the same phrasing that is used of David and Jonathan in 1 Samuel 18:1. The soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. That's how much Jacob loved Benjamin. So at this point, Joseph would begin to see that Judah loves their father just as much as he does. And he would also begin to see that Judah is genuinely concerned about Benjamin's future. Prophetically speaking, Joseph and what he represents, not just the Messiah, but the body of Messiah, Joseph will realize that Judah loves the father just as much as he does. In verses 32 through 34, Judah continues and says, "For your servant became a pledge of safety for the boy to my father, saying, 'If I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father all my life. Now therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the boy as a servant to my lord.'" Let me read that again. "Let your servant remain instead of the boy as a servant to my lord. And let the boy go back with his brothers. For how can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? I fear to see the evil that would find my father." Now, we should probably point out here that the boy is actually about 30 years old or older and has many children. Nonetheless, Judah offers himself in the stead of Benjamin for fear of Jacob's death. And for the rest of his life, he would have to bear the shame and the responsibility of bringing about his father's death. So as we move into chapter 45, let's read verses 1 through 4. It says, "Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him," that is, his Egyptian stewards. "And he cried, 'Make everyone go out from me.' So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, so that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, 'I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?' But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. And so Joseph said to his brothers, 'Come near to me, please.' And they came near, and he said, 'I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt.'" So, after seeing that his brothers loved their father as he did, were devoted to Benjamin, who was Rachel's son, and were remorseful over the treatment that they had given to Joseph, that's when he revealed himself. And his emotions come spilling out in this very visible and this very audible way. And he had sent the Egyptians from the room because, well, he's their Lord. He can tell them what to do. But it's also, I believe, because he didn't want them to be there when he revealed himself. This was going to be a personal family affair. In making himself known, some commentaries suggest that he revealed his circumcision to prove it. It doesn't say in the text, obviously. I don't know, but it is an interesting consideration. But really, he began to make himself known when he says to them, "I am Joseph," because the interpreter is now out of the room. It's just him and his brothers. And so when he spoke to them, he said, "Ani Yosef, I am Joseph, your brother." He spoke to them in Hebrew. Of course, according to the text, this just leaves them dumbfounded. They're standing there. They can't believe their eyes and their ears. And so he calls them to come closer to him, to convince them that it was really him. In other words, their dead brother, whom they had despised, was resurrected right before their very eyes. And so once he's resurrected, so to speak, he calls them to come near to him. Compare this now to when Yeshua's brothers saw the resurrected Messiah. In John chapter 20, beginning at verse 19, it says, "On the evening of that day, the first day of the week, the doors being locked where the disciples were for fear of the Jews, Yeshua came and stood among them and said to them, 'Peace be with you.'" He just appeared before their very eyes out of nowhere. "And when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side." And we'll go down to verse 25. "Now Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin, was not with them when Yeshua came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails, and place my finger into the mark of the nails, and place my hand into his side, I will never believe." 8 days later, his disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them. And although the doors were locked, Yeshua came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." And then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here, and see my hands, and put out your hand, and place it in my side. Don't disbelieve, but believe." In a sense, what he was telling Thomas and the other disciples a week before to do is, "Come here, come close to me, so that you can really see that it's truly me." And at that point, when they realize that he is resurrected, the disciples of the Messiah begin to better understand God's plan and purpose. Because when he had been crucified, they were scattered like sheep. The two disciples on the road to Emmaus were perplexed. This is the one that we thought that was the Redeemer of Israel, but he was crucified, etc. But now that they see him resurrected, all those other things, they didn't understand why they were happening. But now that he's resurrected, they begin to understand God's plan and purposes. And so likewise, when Joseph said, "I am Joseph," and in a sense he is resurrected right before his brothers, I believe his brothers then began to understand God's purposes. And certainly Joseph does. Because only in a moment like this do the events of the past, which were not perceived at the time, only now do they begin to make sense. Now, rabbis say that in the future, that God's going to reveal himself in this manner, I believe, through the Messiah. And he's going to say, "I am Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh," just like Joseph says, "I am Joseph." And he's going to reveal who he is. And they say, the rabbis that is, that the veil is going to be lifted from men's eyes, and then they will understand why all these different things happen. And according to Ezekiel, the Creator says, "And you shall know that I am the Lord, that I am Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh." Now, as Joseph is revealing himself to his brothers, and he's weeping, and he's wailing, it sounds like, the news of this spreads to Pharaoh's house. Literally, it says, he gave forth his voice in weeping, just uncontrollable weeping. Considering that Joseph is a picture of the Messiah, it makes me wonder about the Messiah's response to the brothers coming back together. What would that be in the future? It just makes me wonder. Now, Joseph wished to confirm that his father was indeed alive. Maybe they had been saying that as a ploy to get this man to release them. So he wants to confirm that he is indeed alive. And so that tells us that the most important thing on his mind was the father. In verse 5, he says, "Do not be grieved or angry with yourselves that you sold me." In other words, it was meant to be. This was God's purposes, because Abraham's descendants were determined. It had already been ordained that they were going to descend into Egypt. That's in Genesis chapter 15. But Joseph tells them, "Look, you were just a tool in God's hand. God intended this to happen, and he sent me first of all of Israel, because all of Israel is going to come down to Egypt. But he sent me first in order to preserve life." Again, when we determine things to be bad or good, it's usually based on our flesh, our desires. But these things, many times, are the opposite of the way we perceive them. In other words, those things that we oftentimes perceive as being bad, as it turns out, were good. And those things that we perceive as being good turns out to be not so good. So that's what he was trying to express to them. You did something that was bad, but God meant it for good. At that time, they and Jacob thought that Joseph was dead. But from God's perspective, Joseph had to die. And I use that word tongue in cheek. That Israel might live. Of course, later on, Joseph, in the person of the Messiah, does have to die, literally, that Israel might live. But that was God's purposes. In verse 6, he reveals to them that there are 5 more years of famine. That means for us that this reconciliation takes place 2 years into the famine, and 9 since Joseph has become viceroy. And he tells them that during these next 5 years, there's neither going to be plowing, there's not going to be any harvesting. Prophetically speaking, is this saying that harvests are suspended during this famine, but restoration nonetheless is coming to pass? In Genesis 45, verses 7 and 8, he says, "And God sent me before you to preserve you for a remnant on the earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father," and that word is literally "of." "He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt." Now, there's a possibility, I guess, that up until this point in time, Joseph had blamed them for his affliction. But I believe that the famine and then his brothers descending into Egypt, coming before him, bowing before him, all of these different things, I'm confident it made very clear to him what God's purposes were, or else he would not say what he just said, that God's the one who sent me. Sometimes threats, tribulations, crises, these are the things that serve to bring God's purposes to light. It's hard to see in the daylight many times what you can only see in the dark. So it wasn't really them that sent him to Egypt. It was God, and it was to serve his purposes. They may have been the vessels, but so was Joseph. So again, demonstrating that God uses, quote unquote, bad things to bring about good purposes. And in this instance, and in many throughout the scripture, that purpose is life, preserving his people. There must be willing vessels, though, who will submit to his will, not my will, but your will be done. So Joseph recognized that his suffering was that there might be a remnant and that there might come a great deliverance of God's people. In other words, that all Israel might be saved. He suffered that all Israel might be saved. Likewise, Yeshua's suffering served the same purpose. In Luke 24, when he encounters the two disciples on the road to Emmaus, talking over the events of the last several days, this guy who appeared to be a stranger to them, who they didn't recognize, said to them, "Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and I'll insert this word, then enter into his glory?" The suffering had to come before the glory. In Romans chapter 11, Paul says this in verse 26 and 7, "And in this way all Israel will be saved. As it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion. He will banish ungodliness from Jacob. And this will be my covenant with them when I take away their sins." In other words, Joseph recognized his suffering was a prerequisite to there being a remnant of people and a greater deliverance of more people. And the Messiah says the same thing. The Messiah had to suffer these things and enter into his glory. And because of that, he will save all of Israel, because the deliverer is going to come from Zion, and he's going to remove all their ungodliness. Now in verse 9, Joseph says, after revealing himself, "Go, hurry to my father and say, Joseph says, God has made me ruler of Egypt." In other words, go get my father and bring him to me. And he informs them that when you do this, the entire family is going to live in the land of Goshen with your little ones, with your flocks, with your herds, everything. Bring it down. You're going to live in Goshen. Now, the word Goshen is, to the best that I can detect, of uncertain origin. Nobody's really 100% certain where this word comes from. Now, Brown Driver Briggs, a lexicon, defines the word as meaning to draw near. But that's the only thing I've seen. But other lexicons say that its meaning is uncertain, and so they believe that maybe it's of Egyptian origin. I will confess I don't know. However, I will share this with you. It might be related to, or it may have been derived from, the word goshem or geshem. Instead of a nun on the end, it's gimel shin mem. Goshen is gimel shin nun. And so instead of that nun on the end, the mem on the end gives it the goshem geshem. Now, goshem or geshem means rain. It means a shower of rain. And so perhaps these terms are related, and that's why Goshen would be considered the fattest place of the land, the most fertile part of the land, the best of Egypt. Now, here's a footnote to this. In Genesis 46, verses 28 and 9, Goshen is spelled differently. It's spelled Gimel Shin Nun He, pronounced Goshna. Goshna. Here's why I find that interesting. Because Gimel Shin Nun and He are the letters on a dreidel. And dreidel is associated with the story of Hanukkah. By the way, during the time of Hanukkah, we read the story of Joseph. Miketz, specifically. Hanukkah is about not assimilating, not mixing and mingling with the nations. When Jacob and Israel comes down into Egypt, they're going to live in Goshen, as we're going to see. A great part of the reason they're going to live in Goshen is because it will allow them an opportunity to live set apart from the Egyptians and not be assimilated into the Egyptians. I just thought that was kind of interesting. In verse 17, Joseph says, "And you shall dwell," v'yashavta is the term, v'yashavta, "and you shall dwell." Now, the root word, v'yashavta, that phrase is yashav, yud shin bet, which means to dwell. It's associated with the idea of sitting. But I want you to see in that word, v'yashavta, and I've highlighted it in the outlines, is also the word Shabbat, Shin Bet Tav. It's present there. And so here's a hint as far as I'm concerned. You shall Shabbat in Goshen. You're going to rest from this famine in Goshen. And so God, through Joseph, has prepared a place for the remnant where he would sustain them through the famine. Likewise, we see that Messiah prepares a place for the remnant during a time of tribulation in Revelation chapter 12. But the woman was given the two wings of the great eagle so that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness to the place where she is to be nourished for a time and times and half a time. And down to verse 17, it says, "The dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war on the remnant of her seed, those who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Yeshua." In other words, I just find it very interesting that Goshen is a place for them to not only dwell, but inferred in that word is to rest from the famine that's going on, to be sustained. They had a place prepared for them in the midst of all of the chaos. And so bringing them into Goshen, as I said, also sets them apart from the Egyptians. They're not going to be contaminated with the society and culture in Egypt. There, they could be shepherds, and that was something that was considered to be abominable to the Egyptians, and that means the Egyptians are not going to want to have a whole lot to do with them. So that's going to ensure that Israel would be set apart even while they're in the midst of Egypt. And so Israel's sojourn in Egypt begins as a set-apart people. However, in future Torah portions, we're going to see that would change. And when they come out of Egypt, they're going to be reminded that their mission is to be a set-apart people for this purpose of being a light to all the nations. Now, verse 12, he says to them, "Your eyes see, and the eyes of my brother Benjamin, that my mouth speaks to you." They are his witnesses, in other words, that he is alive. The one who was dead is now alive. And so he says to them in verse 13, "Go report to my father of my glory. Go be my witnesses." Now, it's also calling attention to the fact that he was speaking to them in Hebrew. What did Yeshua tell his disciples? That they are his witnesses and they are going to report to the world. He sends them out to the uttermost parts of the earth. In Genesis 45 verse 14, it says, "Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept. And Benjamin wept upon his neck. And he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. And after that, his brothers talked with them." So this we see is a true reconciliation. And I wanted to point out, unlike the reconciliation that occurs when Esau fell upon Jacob's neck and wept. Because in that case, the two brothers didn't reunite after that. They didn't come together as a family. The record tells us that the next time Esau and Jacob are together is when Isaac is being buried. So, in my opinion, the quote-unquote reconciliation that occurred between Jacob and Esau, as we shared with you in the previous Torah portions, that was there was something in that hug, that embrace, that kiss that told Jacob that Esau has not gotten over his anger. In this reconciliation, we're going to see that the family comes back together. Now, it also reveals to us in this verse that only now do his brothers speak to him. So part of it is probably they're stunned. They're just amazed that their brother has just appeared before them from beneath this veneer of Egypt. It also might be that they were waiting to see how he's going to act to them. Is he going to act towards them the way he does with Benjamin, or is he going to treat us differently? But when he weeps and when he kisses, they see that he is acting toward them just like he does his other brother. And they begin to talk to him. And so tears are shed at the realization that the dead brother is very much alive and well. Which reminds me of this from Zechariah's prophecy in chapter 12. "And I will pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and pleas for mercy, so that when they look upon me, on him whom they have pierced, they shall mourn for him, as one mourns for an only child, and weep bitterly over him, as one weeps over a firstborn." By the way, Joseph was considered to be the firstborn in that he was given the birthright and the blessing. Now also note that this reconciliation that takes place between Joseph and his brothers was on their third meeting. And this occurred over three different days. Thus, this reconciliation took place on the third day, which is important because Hosea in chapter 6 has this to say, "Come, let us return to the Lord, for he has torn us." Remember, Joseph was torn. "He has torn us that he may heal us. He has struck us down and he will bind us up. After 2 days, he will revive us," meaning on the third day, he will raise us up that we may live before him. Now, according to the Midrash, there is another prophetic element to this weeping among the brothers. I will share it with you. I'm not saying that I'm an advocate for it, but I find it interesting. They say in the Midrash that Joseph and Benjamin were weeping over the destruction of the two sanctuaries that would be in their territory. For Benjamin, that would mean the Temple Mount, because the Temple Mount was in Benjamin's tribal allotment. For Joseph, through Ephraim, that would refer to the tabernacle when it was in Shiloh, because that was in the territory given to Ephraim. And the weeping over the brothers is said to be weeping over the future exile of the 10 tribes. Again, I'm just pointing that out because it is of interest. I'm not saying that's in reality what happened. Now in verse 16, we see that the news of Joseph's reconciliation with his brothers reaches Pharaoh, and it tells us it pleased Pharaoh well and his servants. In verses 17 through 20, Pharaoh instructs Joseph to supply his brothers with wagons, with provision, and for them to go fetch their family and their belongings and come back down to Egypt. And he tells them that they will eat the fat of the land. He also tells them, "Don't regard your stuff, for the good things of Egypt are yours," meaning that there was much property that they would have to leave in the land of Canaan, and considering how long they're going to be in Egypt, it was there for a long, long time. Now, it would also be hinted at, I think, here, that as free men, if they're going to come down into Egypt, that they would, as free men, be able to return to Canaan at any time they wanted. But of course, that does not suit God's purposes. In verses 21 through 22, Joseph sends his brothers to Canaan. They are equipped for the journey, and he gives them the wagons. He gives them the provisions. He gives them a change of clothes. Remember, they had rent their garments when the silver cup was found in Benjamin's sack. But to Benjamin, he gave 5 changes of clothes, and he gave him 300 shekels of silver. And there's no indication in the text that this provoked any jealousy among the brothers. In fact, Joseph admonishes them, don't quarrel along the way. To his father, he sends 20 donkeys, and they're laden down with treasure and with food. So when they return to the land of Canaan in verse 26, they told Jacob, Joseph is alive and is ruler over the land of Egypt. And at this news, the text tells us that his heart fainted, and at first he refused to believe them. But then in verse 27, when he saw the wagons that Joseph sent, the spirit of Jacob, their father, revived. So when he saw the evidence that Joseph was indeed alive, then his spirit was revived. That his spirit was revived at the news of Joseph's resurrection reminds us of a prophecy in Ezekiel, chapter 37, beginning at verse 3, and he said to me, Son of man, can these bones live? And I answered, O Lord God, you know. Then he said to me, prophesy over these bones and say to them, O dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord God to these bones, behold, I will cause breath to enter you, and you shall live. And I will lay sinews upon you, and will cause flesh to come upon you, and cover you with skin, and put breath in you, and you shall live. And you shall know that I am the Lord. And we're going down to verse 11. Then he said to me, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Behold, they say, our bones are dried up and our hope is lost. We are indeed cut off. Joseph was cut off. Therefore prophesy and say to them, thus says the Lord God, behold, I will open your graves and raise you from your graves, O my people. And I will bring you into the land of Israel. And you shall know that I am the Lord when I open your graves and raise you from your graves, O my people. And I will put my spirit within you, and you shall live. You will be revived. And I will place you in your own land. Then you shall know that I am the Lord. I have spoken, and I will do it, declares the Lord. So when Jacob receives the evidence that Joseph, who was dead, who was torn, who was devoured, has been resurrected, and is alive, and is supreme ruler of Egypt, or let's put it this way, the world, because we're speaking ultimately of the Messiah, then his spirit is revived. And in this prophecy here, God says, I'm going to resurrect you. I'm going to revive you. Now, Jacob also learns that his once dead son, not only is he alive, but he has not been lost to Egyptian influence. He has been raised, so to speak, and is a true son of Jacob. He's a true son of Israel. Thus, Jacob was revived. Breath came into him. And notice that in the next verse, Jacob is called Israel, which, of course, represents the nation. In verse 28, it says, and Israel said, it is enough. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die. All right, now as we go into chapter 46, beginning with verses 1 through 4, it says, so Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here am I. Then he said, I am God, the God of your fathers. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you into a great nation. I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also bring you up again, and Joseph's hand shall close your eyes. So before departing for Egypt, he goes to Beersheba and offers sacrifices to God because, number one, this is where God appeared to Abraham. This is where Isaac had built an altar and had lived. In fact, Isaac, you recall, had intended to go down into Egypt, but he was told not to. So apparently that factors into Jacob's concern about going down to Egypt because he's obviously troubled, or God doesn't have to tell him, don't be afraid. I'd also point out that Jacob had to know that going down to Egypt was playing a role in what God had told Abraham. And it was equivalent to what Abraham had been told, that your descendants are going to be sojourners in a land that's not their own, and they're going to be oppressed, but I'm going to deliver them, etc. Now, when it uses the term night visions or visions of the night, that is said to imply the idea of an impending gloom, an impending darkness. And so it's hinting once again that Jacob is very concerned about what to do here, because he knows that his father was told not to go to Egypt. He knows that Abraham was told that his descendants were going to go somewhere and be oppressed and be sojourners, and so he's very troubled. But it's in the midst of this night vision or this dread of gloom and darkness that God tells him not to fear, because all of this was part of God's plan. As a matter of fact, he tells them that in Egypt, that's where you're going to become a great nation. That's where I'm going to really multiply you. Now, there is a footnote here. Rabbis believe that because this instruction comes to him in the evening, and it's in the midst of these very troubling circumstances, that is why that Jacob instituted what's called the Ma'ariv, or the evening prayer. And that was intended to teach that darkness is only a prelude to the light that comes in the morning. As the psalmist says, weeping may tarry for the night, but joy comes with the morning. So, according to the rabbinical commentary anyway, the Ma'ariv, the evening prayer, that's what it's about. It's about, even though we're facing the darkness, we know that once we get through the darkness, that there's going to be light in the morning. So in this night vision, God tells him, do not fear, but he promised, I'm going to go with you and I'm going to bring you out. So that might be telling him that I'm going to go with you personally and I'm going to bring you out personally, because when you come out, you're going to be buried in the land of Canaan. But I believe that in addition to that, he's saying, I'm going to be with you and your descendants while they're in Egypt, and I'm going to bring your descendants out of Egypt in the Exodus. When he says that Joseph's hand shall close your eyes, what he was meaning was, when Jacob, when you die, it will be Joseph, your son, who actually closes your eyes for you. In verses 5 through 7, it says, then Jacob set out from Beersheba. And the sons of Israel carried Jacob their father, their little ones, and their wives in the wagons that Pharaoh had sent to carry him. They also took their livestock and their goods, which they had gained in the land of Canaan, and came into Egypt. Jacob and all his offspring with him, his sons and his sons' sons with him, his daughters and his sons' daughters, all his offspring he brought with him into Egypt. And so Jacob, who is the seed of Abraham, goes down into Egypt, which I would liken to the womb. And that's where it grows and that's where it multiplies. Because when a father's seed impregnates the mother's egg, inside the womb is where the baby develops. It's where the cells divide. It's where they multiply. It's where it grows. It matures. It takes on shape. And as it grows, it takes up more and more of that space in the womb. But the point is, it's in the womb that it multiplies. It's in the womb that it's nourished and it's cared for and it grows. But the womb is to serve a purpose for only a while, 40 weeks. And once the womb has served its purpose, then we come to the time that there has to be travail. There has to be the labor pangs. The baby has to come forth from the womb. Because if the baby were to remain in the womb, the baby would eventually die. The womb would become its tomb. That's not God's intention. Once the womb has served its purpose, it's time for that baby to come forth from the womb to be the man or the woman that God has created them to be. And so, again, I say that Egypt, Mitzrayim, represents the womb. It served its purpose. The seed of Abraham goes down into the womb. There is this conception, if you will. And then there's the multiplying, there's the growing, there's the taking shape, etc., until there comes a time when the womb has to give up the baby. Because if the baby stays in the womb, it's going to die. In this case, had Israel remained in Egypt for all time, Israel would have ceased to exist. And so the womb, when it's served its purpose, when Egypt served its purpose, then the baby had to come forth. Then the son had to be born. Hosea 11 says this, "When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son." As a matter of fact, we could even share with you how that when Israel finally comes out of Egypt, it's actually through the Red Sea, when he parted the Red Sea, because technically speaking, on the one side of the Red Sea, they're still in Egypt. Pharaoh's pursuing, and so God opens up the waters and brings them through the Red Sea on the other side. The breaking water is the sign to the mother that now is the time for the son or the child to be delivered. So they go down into Egypt in order to grow and to multiply. But they are going to be brought out at the appointed time. So in verses 8 through 15, the text lists all of those who are of Jacob who were born to him by Leah. That was 33 souls, it says. In verses 16 through 18, it lists the sons of Jacob born to him by Zilpah. That was 16. Verses 19 through 22, it lists those who were born by Rachel. That was 14. And then in verses 23 through 25, it lists those who were born to Jacob by Bilhah. They were 7 souls. And you add all those up, it comes up to 70 souls. So in verses 26 and 7, it tells us all the persons belonging to Jacob who came into Egypt, who were his own descendants, not including Jacob's sons' wives, were 66 persons in all. And the sons of Joseph who were born to him in Egypt were 2. All the persons of the house of Jacob who came into Egypt were 70. In verse 28, it says that he sent Judah before him to Joseph to show the way for him to Goshen. Judah always leads the way, including going down into Egypt. In the wilderness, it's Judah's camp that leads the way. So Judah always goes first. The plain meaning of this verse is that Judah just went down to find out where we're supposed to go, where we're supposed to live. But the Hebrew word that is translated to show, to direct, is lehorot. Lehorot, lamed, he, vav, resh, tav. And it comes from the root word yara. Yara, yud, resh, he. An alternate spelling is with the aleph at the end. Yara. But the root word means to direct, to point, to teach. In fact, it is the root word for Torah. So it's implying here that Jacob sent Judah ahead into Goshen, not only to find where we're supposed to live, but to establish a house of study. Reinforcing that in Goshen, Israel would be able to live a set apart life, because when Israel is studying God's instructions and living by God's instructions, they will be a set apart people. In verses 29 through 30, it says, "Then Joseph prepared his chariot and went up to meet Israel, his father, in Goshen. He presented himself to him and fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. Israel said to Joseph, 'Now let me die, since I have seen your face and know that you are still alive.'" You know, when I was reading this as a father, I just can't begin to imagine the emotions that were going through Jacob's mind and his heart, and Joseph as well, thinking that your son was dead and to find out that he's alive and to see him with your own eyes. We just can't imagine the emotions that were on display here. And so when Jacob sees him, it's like, "Now I can die a content and happy man because I have seen your face." And here's what that reminds me of. What Simeon said at Yeshua's appearance in Luke chapter 2. "Now there was a man in Jerusalem whose name was Simeon, and this man was righteous and devout, waiting for the consolation of Israel, and the Holy Spirit was upon him. And it had been revealed to him by the Holy Spirit that he would not see death before he had seen the Lord's Messiah. And he came in the Spirit into the temple, and when the parents brought in the child Yeshua to do for him according to the custom of the law, he took him up in his arms and blessed God and said, Lord, now you are letting your servant depart in peace, according to your word. For my eyes have seen your salvation, that you have prepared in the presence of all peoples a light for revelation to the Gentiles and for glory to your people Israel. Now, at this reconciliation between Jacob and Joseph, here's the thought that popped into my mind. Did Jacob say, what happened? What really happened? In other words, did Jacob ever really find out what happened between Joseph and his brothers? Now, rabbinical commentary says no, and it isn't really mentioned in Scripture. Maybe Joseph did not want to uncover their nakedness, so to speak. And if that's the case, then that is further proof that he forgave them fully. And it's proof that he understood that all of his suffering was part of God's plan, that he was sent to be salvation prepared in the presence of the nations or the peoples. Now, there's later on in the next Torah portion something that Jacob has to say when he blesses Joseph that might lead one to believe that, well, maybe he did know. But the point is, the record never states. We're left to kind of question, did Jacob find out all the details? We don't know. In verses 31 through 34, Joseph informs that he's going to go to Pharaoh and he's going to solidify the situation for Israel in Goshen. And he instructs them that when Pharaoh asks, what do you do? What's your vocation? You tell him that you're keepers of cattle from your youth. Why? Because this would be considered an abomination unto the Egyptians. Why would Joseph want them to know to say this, considering that what they did was an abomination to the Egyptians? Because this is just another way that will ensure that Israel will be able to live a set apart life from the Egyptians. They're going to be spared the corrupt influence of Egypt, but without being dishonest. And so Pharaoh would let them live in Goshen unmolested because of the disdain that Egyptians had for shepherds. Now in chapter 47, verse 1 tells us that Joseph told Pharaoh, my father and brothers and flocks are in the land of Goshen. And so it would seem that once they're there, they're all kind of settled in, it wouldn't really be right for him to uproot them and have them move somewhere else. So Joseph tells him that, then he presents five of his brothers to Pharaoh. He doesn't tell us which five. And when they were asked by Pharaoh, what is your vocation? They respond, we're shepherds, which is going to, again, make sure that they can live a set apart life. It's going to disqualify them from serving in some other post that Pharaoh may have had in mind. But Joseph makes sure that his family is isolated from the rest of Egypt and for their benefit. And so that is another piece of evidence that tells us of his great concern for his family. In verse 4, the brothers say to Pharaoh, there is no pasture in Canaan because of the famine. Please allow us to sojourn in Goshen. Now, if there's no pasture in Canaan, but they want to sojourn in Goshen, that would imply that there was pasture land in Goshen, maybe watered by the Nile. Who knows? Pharaoh replies in verse 6, Egypt is before you. In the best of the land, which is Goshen, is where your family will dwell. And he adds at the end of this statement that if there are any qualified among your brothers, Joseph, then let them oversee my cattle. At this, in verses 7 through 10, Jacob is presented to Pharaoh. Jacob blesses Pharaoh. And during this conversation between Pharaoh and Jacob, we learn that at that point in time, Jacob was 130 years old. So after the meeting with Pharaoh, it says in verses 11 and 12, then Joseph settled his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had commanded. And Joseph provided his father, his brother, and all of his father's household with food according to the number of their dependents. And so we see here that Goshen is also known as the land of Ramses, and I believe, from what I've read, that seems to be a name that was given to it later. Not in Joseph's day, but later on, in fact, during the time when Israel was being oppressed, which hints at this fact, that the Pharaoh who comes later does not really respect and honor the wishes of his predecessor, who allowed Israel to settle in the land of Goshen. In verse 13, it tells us, "Now there was no food in all the land, for the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished by reason of the famine." But when it says all the land, literally it says all the earth, implying that this famine engulfed the entire known world at least. And as far as I'm concerned, this has prophetic implications. When it engulfs all the earth, that means that there's going to be a future famine that's going to affect the entire world at the end of days. And of course, in Revelation chapter 6, verses 5 and 6, we have evidence of that. "When he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, 'Come,' and I looked, and behold, a black horse. And its rider had a pair of scales in his hand, and I heard what seemed to be a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, 'A quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine.'" And so what this describes is a day when a measure of wheat, enough to feed one person for one day, or enough barley to feed three people for one day, is going to cost a day's wages. And so if I go out and work a day and I want to eat wheat that day, I'll make enough just to feed me for that one day. Or if I want to buy barley, I can feed me, my wife, and one of my four children. But what am I going to do about my other children? And so what does this insinuate? Hyperinflation that has been caused by very intense food shortages. However, notice that the oil and the wine are not to be harmed. And so is that literal or is it figurative? Or maybe both. And if it's figurative, consider this. We, the people of God, are part of a cultivated olive tree, according to Romans chapter 11, which is going to be the source for oil. According to the words of the Messiah, we are branches of the true vine. And what grows on the branches of the vine? The fruit. And what does the fruit produce? The wine. So Joseph sustained his family in the midst of this famine. He gave them what they needed, their daily bread, so to speak. And Joseph is a type of the Messiah. So I believe that what we see here and what we just read in Revelation 6, that in the midst of this worldwide famine, that the Messiah will sustain his family as well. He will give us our daily bread. Does that mean literally, physically, or is it speaking spiritually? And my answer to that would be yes. Now, verse 14, it says that Joseph gathered the money found in Egypt and Canaan from the wheat that people had bought. And so Joseph accumulated all this wealth for Pharaoh. In verse 15, it says, "And when the money was all spent in the land of Egypt," when all the people in Egypt have spent all their money, "and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, 'Give us food. Why should we die before your eyes? For our money is gone.'" An alternate translation says, "Our money has failed," or "it has come to an end." So because of the famine and the supposed hyperinflation, the money has now failed, which I believe also hints at future events. And so in verse 16, Joseph said, "Give me your cattle if your money has failed," which is what they did. In exchange for food, they gave him their property, their livestock. So the picture is they exchanged their property. They gave it to the government in exchange for food. But that only lasted for a year. Which year of the famine was this taking place? There are varying opinions. Some opinions say it's the first year of the famine. Some say it's the third year of the famine because the reconciliation takes place between the brothers 2 years into the famine. Some say it's the sixth year of the famine. I don't know. But we do know that during the midst of the famine, the Egyptians, their money failed. Their currency failed. And then they're forced to exchange property for food, and they're giving their property to the government. Now, verses 18 through 20, it says, "And when that year was ended, they came to him the following year and said to him, 'We will not hide from our Lord that our money is all spent. The herds of livestock are my Lord's. There is nothing left in the sight of my Lord but our bodies and our land. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for food, and we with our land will be servants to Pharaoh. And give us seed that we may live and not die, and that the land may not be desolate. So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. For all the Egyptians sold their fields because the famine was severe on them, and the land became Pharaoh's. So there are a few things we need to point out here. Number one, desperate people are willing to give away their property for sustenance. Esau comes in famished, thinking he's going to die, and he gives away his birthright. Desperate people will give away their birthright for sustenance. Desperate people will give away their property, their liberties, for sustenance. Desperate people will become slaves to the government in exchange for security. Now, in this particular case, Joseph obliges the people. He makes them totally dependent upon Pharaoh. And the question is, why? Why would a righteous man do that? I can only conclude this, that in the end, it serves God's purposes. But this also paints a picture of the world at the end, to borrow from our previous Torah portion, Miketz, at the end. And I believe that as we look around in the world and in our country, we can see the mindset of people today is just that. They are willing to exchange liberty. They are willing to exchange property. They're willing to exchange the birthright for sustenance in order that somebody be there to take care of me so I don't have to worry about this. The Egyptians were willing to sell themselves to the government in exchange for food. Again, Esau sold his birthright for food. Here's an interesting quote attributed to George Washington in 1789. He wrote that America would continue until the people of America shall have lost all virtue, until they shall have become totally insensible to the difference between freedom and slavery, until they shall have been reduced to such poverty of spirit as to be willing to sell that preeminent blessing, the birthright of a free man, for a mess of pottage. In other words, alluding to Esau. In short, until they have been found incapable of governing themselves and ripe for a master. As far as I'm concerned, that seems to be the mindset, not only of Americans, but of the world. And that apparently, because of the crisis, was the mindset of the Egyptians of that day. Now, it doesn't say here that Joseph took possession of the people. It says he took possession of the land. However, in verse 23, it will tell us that Joseph said, I have bought you this day and your land. And so it seems that the Egyptians and their property became the property of Pharaoh. Now, there were two exceptions to this. The priests of Egypt, and I would suggest they were the elites of Egypt. And the other exception was the Hebrews. The Hebrews, the seed of Abraham, were living set-apart lives in Goshen. And to me, that speaks volumes. It should tell us that those of us who are called to be a set-apart people, a light to the nations, should not act like the nations and rely on the government. You should not exchange your freedoms, birthright, property, whatever. You should not exchange that for food and things that puts you in a position that you are the property of the government or a government. In effect, the Egyptians got a bailout, but the Hebrews had no need of one. They didn't look to the Egyptian government, per se, as their source. We should not look to any government as our source. Psalm 121 says this, I will lift up my eyes to the hills. From where does my help come? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. You see, there are a lot of people who are looking to Capitol Hill to be their source. but we are to look into the hills from where our help comes from, because it comes from the maker of heaven and earth. Now, in verse 21, it says, "And as for the people, he removed them city by city from one border to the other." So apparently, because they had turned over their property in exchange for food, they were relocated city by city. That in part was going to demonstrate that they no longer had claim of ownership to their lands. But that also hints to me that they're more or less forced to go where the government determined that they must go. Maybe it was that the cities were these distribution points for food, and so they had to go where the food was. But the point is, they had to do that because they were dependent on the government for food. Now, in verse 22, it says, "Only the land of the priest he did not buy, because they had a portion from Pharaoh." Now, on this note, I want to read you what a rabbinical commentary has to say. Quote, "By giving a privileged status to the clergy, Joseph established a precedent that made it possible for the tribe of Levi to be exempt from the servitude to which the Egyptians later subjugated the other tribes, so that there would be a strong nucleus of people who kept alive the teachings of the patriarchs." Now, whether or not that is true, I don't know. However, I will point this out. Aaron, Moses' brother, who was of the tribe of Levi, certainly seemed to have freedom of movement during the time he was in Egypt. In fact, in Exodus chapter 4, verse 27, he went and met Moses at Sinai. So if he was a slave in Egypt with no freedom of movement, how does he do that? He also goes with Moses to meet with Pharaoh, and that's in Exodus chapter 5. That's the first time. So make of that what you will, but it does seem that Aaron of the tribe of Levi has some kind of freedom of movement here. In verses 23 and 4, Joseph then gives the people the terms for serving Pharaoh. They would sow the land, even though the land now belongs to Pharaoh. But you're going to sow the land, and here's what you're going to do, and this is how you're going to earn your livelihood. They would basically work as sharecroppers, and they would be provided the seed from the government. In reality, the terms that he gave them were very, very generous. They could keep 80% to live on, only going to give Pharaoh 20%. But the bottom line is they had sold their lands. They had sold themselves. They had sold their properties. Here was their response to Joseph. "You have saved our lives. We will be Pharaoh's bondsmen." In verse 27 of chapter 47, it says this, "Thus Israel settled in the land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen, and they gained possessions in it and were fruitful and multiplied greatly." So not only did Israel have a place to live, but they acquired possessions. One translation is property in Egypt. While the Egyptians were selling themselves and their property, the Hebrews are prospering in the midst of famine. I believe one reason is because they were living a set-apart life, because there is an inherent blessing in living that set-apart life in the midst of Egypt. But acquiring these possessions or property in Egypt also is going to hint at future complications, because those blessings and that property and those possessions are going to take hold of them. And at some point, they're going to begin to assimilate into Egyptian culture, spread out through the land of Egypt, until there arises a king who knew not Joseph. And with that, we come to the end of the Torah portion, Vayigash. Thank you for joining me. Shalom.
Like what you're hearing? Become a BillCloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BillCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.